Queen Victoria famously began a campaign against women's rights, saying that she was most anxious to enlist everyone who can speak or write to join in checking this mad, wicked folly of women's rights. Feminists, she wrote, ought to get a good whipping. The quote appears in philosopher A.C. Grayling's new book, Towards the Light, the story of the struggles for liberty and rights that made the modern West. In it, he places the movement for women's suffrage in a direct line from the Reformation and through the Enlightenment to the workers' rights movement and the campaign to end slavery. It was a natural step, he says, from the abolitionist cause to women's rights. So how much are women's rights a subsection of human rights? I'm joined by the author and Anthony Grayling, and from Manchester by Sheila Robotham, Professor of Gender and Labour History at Manchester University. Anthony, to what extent do you see women's rights going hand in hand with Enlightenment values of liberty and freedom?
It was a very natural outcome of the movement in the 18th century, which was itself the flowering, really, of what had begun in the 16th century when the Reformation made liberty of conscience, the freedom to think and believe in your own preferred way, a great debating point, especially when the Protestant movements themselves began to persecute people who were heterodox. And during the 17th century in the Scientific Revolution, the importance of a freedom to think and inquire for yourself was one of the main motors driving that.
But hasn't it been about the rights of man? The Western liberal tradition has been about promoting the rights of man, hasn't it?
Well, of course, but in those two centuries, in the 16th, 17th century, women were so disenfranchised that these claims to a right to think freely and to have a free conscience seemed mainly to benefit men. But in the 17th century, with the dissenting movements among Protestants, women were given increasingly more opportunity to speak, to have a say in those movements, especially, for example, among Quakers. So they were allowed to, you know, stand up and speak in meetings. And by the 18th century, when the abolitionist movement had begun, because by this time, of course, the idea of freedom had extended to freedom of the person, political liberty, it was no longer possible to deny the argument put by many eloquent women, and particularly by Mary Wollstonecraft, that freeing slaves was a very noble endeavour, but the slave in the kitchen ought to be looked to as well.
Sheila, do you agree that women's rights go very much hand in hand with this development of human rights?
Yes,
rights?
I do agree with Anthony, and I really enjoyed reading Towards the Light, which is written with incredible clarity. I think what I would do as somebody who spent my time studying the history of women's social movements and labour movements would be to model the argument a little. And I'm sure that he wouldn't like this because he needs to keep a short book. But the whole story is rather more complicated because, as you said, it's completely right. Rights of men did leave women out. And people like Mary Wollstonecraft, who does figure in the book and who's a really great figure, challenged that. But when she challenged it, she was attacked in a rather different way from how a man would be attacked. I mean, this very reactionary figure called Richard Polwheel said Mary Wollstonecraft and other female advocates of democracy were unsexed. And that tended to be the ways in which any women who stuck up for themselves were characterised. Either they were unsexed or they were far too sexy, and Mary Wollstonecraft got both. So the rights of men did leave women out, but also women had to question the context in which rights were defined, because very often it didn't simply leave women out, even if they admitted women. They didn't bring in the areas of experience which were important to women in relation to the domestic activity of housework, childcare, and birth control, sexual self-determination, which were seen as personal.
And what about this sort of argument that the different but equal, Anthony? I mean, there have been times when women's rights have been regarded as actually different to human rights.
Well, yes, I think that is part of the response to the fact that in the 19th century, the opposition to the first wave of feminism, as it's sometimes called now, sometimes took the form, in fact, very often took the form of saying that there were all sorts of intellectual and physiological reasons why women shouldn't be given the sorts of responsibilities and rights and freedoms that men had. It would be bad for them. They wouldn't have, be able to have babies properly and etc. And it was in opposition to that opposition, I think, that some people came up with the idea that, all right, except that there are differences, but nevertheless recognised that in very, very significant political and social respects that there had to be a certain kind of equality. And I don't think that argument is a good one. I mean, if we fast forward now to United Nations Declaration of Universal Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the chairperson for that, was very keen after it was adopted by the UN that people should recognise that this genuinely did apply independently of gender, of creed, of race, of anything else. And it was the gender issue that exercised her particularly, because she wanted to say the possession of these rights and their exercise of them premises nothing whatever about who does that exercising. So whether you're a man or a woman doesn't make any difference at all. And that argument about different but equal, therefore, at least she rejected it.
That's an interesting point you pick up on there, because Eleanor Roosevelt rejected the idea of having a separate section for women's rights. But others, Indian women, those not from the West, disagreed with her, didn't they?
Well, it's quite interesting with Eleanor Roosevelt, because in the earlier period she had recognised certain differences in working class women's position, because she was more aligned with some of the social reformers. And they'd argued that because it was so difficult in the American context to get protection for both men and women, that as an interim measure you needed to go for protection for women. And then that got them stuck, as Anthony says, it got them stuck into that being enclosed in their difference problem. And by the time she gets into the United Nations, she's arguing very impressively for a combination of individual and social rights. But she didn't really see there was a need for any special area of the United Nations for women. And it was feminists in Britain, and also the Indian woman representative, who said, well, you know, you may think that the men in America are going to accept that women are included, but we're not going to rely on that in India, and we believe that we need a separate section working around women.
And maybe so have a different conception of women's
rights.
It's
how you combine equality and recognition of specificity, I think.
Anthony, in some ways your book seems quite old-fashioned. It looks like an 18th century pamphlet. Why did you feel the need to write this book now?
Well, because in response to the terrorist threat and the rather inflamed international situation that we have at the moment, most of our liberal Western democracies, especially in the United Kingdom and the United States, are ratcheting back on our civil liberties in the interests of promoting our security.
And you say our future lies with women.
Oh, well, that too, yes, because if you look at the fact that the West has developed in tandem, in a way, with the enfranchisement of women in many respects, and contrast that to parts of the world where women are very disenfranchised. The fact, for example, that in the Middle East, which is a country, an area of the world where oil wealth is enjoyed by rather few, but the rest of the of development still lags behind. You've got nearly 50% of the women in that part of the world illiterate, and there has to be a connection, I think, between literacy, enfranchisement, rights, and the ability to exercise those rights by women. They are, in many ways, the future of the world. And if we are going to have a chance of peace and progress in the world, everywhere in the developing world, in the Middle East and elsewhere, women have got to be enfranchised.
It's a fascinating debate. I wish we could continue it. Maybe off air. Anthony Grayling and Sheila Robotham, thank you very much.